All right, welcome to Greek Club at Concordia Seminary. We are reading through Galatians. We're in chapter 4, and we read verse 23 last week, just to repeat. Or maybe we didn't. Maybe we only read verse 22. I think we read verse 22. For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one from the slave girl and one from the free girl or free woman, right? Yes, and so we're at verse 23 now, and let's just pick up with a little bit of Greek there. So, al ha men ek tes paidiskes katasarka gegenetai hade ek tes eleutheras de epangelias. So, all there, of course, is just Allah, and the because it's got a vowel following it, the alpha is elided, right, taken off. But, on the one hand, we've got men and then a da following. On the one hand, the of the slave girl one, and the article there just is turning the prepositional phrase into a noun, the of the slave girl son, right? And so that becomes a subject of the verb. Let's see, we got room over here. And you get extra credit if you sit right here next to me. So, and we'll make Celeska stand if he shows up. So, so that's the subject of the verb, and the verb is gagenetai, which you ought to be able to at least partly parse from genao. What stem is it? Anybody?
Perfect.
Perfect. See the duplication on the front. And Hebrew Club, come to Hebrew Club.
We're starting too early.
No, I'm just kidding. No, it's in 2 days. Tim, we got places to sit here, man.
Okay.
All right. Perfect, and you can see the tie ending, so it's going to be perfect, active, or perfect active, perfect indicative, middle or passive, and probably almost certainly here passive. So, hey, Andy. So the one of the slave girl has been born, katasarka, according to the flesh. Right. Now, sarx can be just a neutral term meaning physical body, but you just look for what it's paired up with here. And here, of course, it's paired up as contrast to promise in the next clause. So the reference is to the fact that Abraham took matters into his own hands, right? Well, actually, Sarah kind of helped him, right? Because isn't she the one who told Abraham, take my slave girl? So in Genesis. And then the other shoe drops on the de, so we have men and de. So on the other hand, the from the free woman, ha ektes eleutheras, and now we have to just repeat the verb, has been born, and is in a born condition, de epangelias, through a promise. Right? So that part's easy enough. Paul is just kind of reporting the narrative here. And so it's pretty easy grammatically and hermeneutically, if I can say it that way. Man, we've got all kinds of Greek Club people here today. If you guys don't come back for Hebrew Club, you're a bunch of godless pagans. So. Okay. Yeah, we'll take... Earl, sit right here, man. Sure. All right. Point guard, right? We'll just ask the hard questions now. Okay, any questions on verse 23? Pretty straightforward. Again, a good example of what Greek loves to do is put an article in front of something, which turns it into a noun, in this case. And we're going to see that in just a second, actually, as well, in a slightly different way. Any questions on verse 23? Okay, great. Verse 24. Hatena estin allegorumena hautai gar asin dua diatheke miamen apa arus sina ace duleon genosa hatis estin hagar. The words get shorter and shorter as these sentences go on. Verse 25 is an interesting verse. Okay, verse 24. Hatena is from hostis, of all things, which is just probably working here like hos, but it's compound, hos and tis. And so it, when it parses out, you actually change both forms. So this is hos, and this is the neuter plural nominative, so hos has become ha, and it's tis, and the neuter plural nominative of tis is tina. So you actually take the pieces apart, parse them out, and then put them back together. It's a weird looking form. I mean, it may look very strange to you. It just means, for all that work, what does it mean? Which. Which things, neuter plural, right? And then we've got esten allegorumena, which can be taken at least two different ways. The participle there, allegorumena, is from allegoreo, which means to allegorize, right? And actually I was thinking Dr. Seleska, with his expertise in the history of interpretation, could probably wax eloquently on allegorical interpretation. So, but this is Greek club, right? So we don't do fun stuff, we just do grammar. So now, what would you call it if you just take that participle and run it with the linking verb there? What kind of participle construction would that be called?
Paraphrastic.
This is the so-called paraphrastic. And if that's the way you take it, you just run it together as if it were just the linking verb, and you translate, which things are being allegorically interpreted or are being allegorized, just like a compound verb. Now, the other way to take it, interestingly, I brought Burton's commentary on Galatians with me. He actually takes allegorumena as a substantive. That is, it's a participle that's acting like a noun, even though there's no article on it. Okay, and this is possible in Greek. So he's, to use Dr. Velz's categories, he's deciding that the participle, even without a noun, in context, is attributive position, substantive. Right? Which things are allegorically interpreted things? Okay. And you just kind of have to make the decision as to which is the more likely reading. To be honest, I don't know which is the majority way of taking it. I guess I've always read it as which things are being allegorically interpreted. Okay. And one reason I like that is because this is a little weird for Paul. I mean, Paul doesn't kind of do this kind of Old Testament reading, at least to use a word that moderns might use, this blatantly anywhere else. Okay. And so one question is just a guess, just to get away from grammar for a second, is that the reason he does this is because the Judaizers are doing it. Okay. And now he's going to out allegorize them. He's going to take a text that they've been reading allegorically, and he's going to do it better, except he's going to turn the tables on them. Okay. Now, that's just a guess, and we kind of have to leave it in that realm. So maybe we'll just take it as a paraphrastic participle. Which things are being allegorically interpreted? Now, he explains. For, hautai, this is the demonstrative pronoun, these things, feminine plural nominative, subject, are... And now the predicate nominative. Two covenants. And then literally, one on the one hand, from Mountain Sinai. Arus might fool you. It looks like an accusative plural. It's actually a third declension, ta arus, and the genitive singular is arus. So it's just genitive singular after a pa. Right? One, on the other hand, from Mount, comma, Sinai. Literally, into servitude or slavery, begetting. Say the participle there, genosa, is from genao, and the alpha in the stem lengthens to omega. You add the sigma of the weak stem, and you've got a participle. And the referent is mia, right? Again, reading around. Burton takes the participle, actually, with the referent mia, as adjectival, even though there's no article on it. If that's the case, one, on the one hand, one, from Mount Sinai, which gives birth unto slavery. And then Paul continues to explain, hatis, now there's that same, we saw hatina, there's the same thing. This would be just feminine singular nominative, hatis. which is Hagar. Okay. Now at this point, your your brain is spinning because you're trying to keep the correspondences. Like, okay, who is what? You know, and set, you know, what's what? Now the good thing is this is Greek club, and you don't have to figure all that stuff out. You just have to read the grammar. Right? Mm-hmm. So, any questions about verse 25? Questions of any kind?
You're just wrapping it out on my question.
Did I really? Yeah, I know. Yeah, all the hermeneutical, interpretive. I know. Yeah. It's really a very challenging text to know precisely how is Paul making these correspondences. At the very least, it's a stick in the eye of the Judaizers, because they're at least in some sense saying that, look, real freedom, real belonging to the people of God comes by some obedience, at least, to the Sinai covenant. And Paul says, oh yeah, that's a covenant, all right. But that's the one that gives birth to slavery. Right? And so it's completely reversing what seems to have been, as far as we can read back, the argument of the Judaizers. So, right. And all the interesting stuff we'll just have to talk about. We can talk about it at Hebrew Club. We've got lots of time there, right? All right. Okay, any questions? Just a bunch of short clauses, you know, that do present, noteworthy sort of interpretive challenges. So that's on the one hand. That's the one covenant, the one that gives birth unto slavery. Right. Okay? Anything? All right, very good. Verse 25. Tada hagar sena ara sestin ente ara bi'a. Sistoihe de te nun Yerusalem du leuegar mataton technon autes. Now this verse 25 seems to be kind of an explanation. Note the article on Hagar. See? And I might almost render that the Hagar thing, or the Hagar reality, or something like that. Because Hagar is a woman's name. If it had an article, it wouldn't have the neuter singular nominative article. It would have the feminine singular. So, the Hagar reality, Sinai Mountain is. Now, again, because of word order, you can put that on the other side of the verb. Is Mount Sinai in the Arabia, or in Arabia. Now, finally, we get a real verb that is good enough to have to look up. Sustoicheo, it's an epsilon contract, and it means to line up with, or to correspond to. Okay? And the subject is not stated, but it probably has to be Hagar, right? She corresponds to. And sustoicheo will take a dative object. So she corresponds to the now Jerusalem. Okay, now grammatically, there's a basic verb stoicheo, right? And this is sustoicheo. So you've got sun on the front, right? Now, why does it make sense that sustoicheo would take a dative object? Because sun takes the dative. You see this a lot with compound verbs in Greek. If you've got a preposition on the front and then a basic stem, the compound verb will take a direct object with the case that that preposition often governs. Right? And so that's what you've actually got here. It happens a fair amount. So she corresponds to the now Jerusalem. And there, Jerusalem, sort of representing Second Temple Judaism. I can say it that way. Jerusalem is the city. Back in chapter 2, people came from Jerusalem to oppose Paul and his properly understood law-free gospel. Right? Now, Paul knows that there are abuses. There's antinomianism lurking in the bushes. Right? And he'll take care of that in chapter 5. Right? But first he has to show the extent to which Galatians 2:20, I died to the law in order that I might live to God. So first he has to get the gospel back in them, and then he can talk about the response to the gospel, which is to serve one another. Right? First he's got to set them free, before he can enslave him again, if I can say it that way, right? Which is Luther, right? The freedom of the Christian, right? As we members of the exegetical department are happy to say, Luther didn't make it up; he got it from the Bible. Right, so, and I think Luther, I hear Luther liked the Old Testament too. Is that right, Tim? Yeah, it is. Right. All right. She corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery, or she slaves away with the children of her. Right. All right. Questions about verse 25. Again, pretty short. The grammar is not too hard.
Does that, like when you said the Hagar reality, does that happen, is that pretty isolated, or does that happen often?
You can, yeah. You want to see the best example in Paul that I know of? We'll go to Romans 8. Yeah, it's easy to do, Josh, and I don't know how many times Paul does it, but. And this is very difficult to translate. Yeah, Romans 8, 3. Yeah. See, we've got Romans 8:3. Ta gar dunatan tu namu en ho esthene diate sarkas, comma. Right? That little ta there is turning everything from adunatan to the comma into a noun. Okay? So, you might translate that, the inability of the law in which it was weak because of through the flesh. Thing. Right, that reality. And by the way, I'm happy to say that here, at least in my opinion, that is an adverbial accusative of respect. And if you didn't have a headache before, you've got one now. Right? It's very different.
It happens with infinitives, right? When you want to make the infinitive kind of with the nominal or substantive
right.
qualities come out.
Slap an article on it. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. And the maddening thing is that if it always did it, it would be great, like with an infinitive. But sometimes there won't be an article. Or with a participle. Sometimes there won't be an article. You just kind of have to feel the context. Right? So, which is why Greek is a thinking man's language.
Right? That's why I like Hebrew.
Hebrew Club. Don't forget Hebrew Club. Right. All right. So it is fairly common.
Okay.
And Paul does like to do that. So other Greek writers do. Okay, other things on verse 25. Anything? Okay, good questions. Verse 26. Now we have the other hand. He de ano Yerusalem, elu thera estin, hetus estin mater hemon. So we've had the now Jerusalem, but Paul now says, but the above Jerusalem, ano just simply means above, the above Jerusalem free is free, Eleuthera, it would be the predicate nominative, right? Feminine singular nominative with the linking verb. Which, hetis, is the mother of us. She is our, we probably want to add, spiritual mother, right? Now, when you think of the above Jerusalem, of course I have to say this because I am the captain of the eschatology police. Don't think that Paul is, you know, talking about salvation in terms of going up, see? Think of Revelation 21 and 22, see? Think of the new Jerusalem, which God has prepared, but which comes down, right? See? So that new Jerusalem is already a reality because of Christ's death and resurrection and the gift of the Holy Spirit. But the fullness remains, you know, for the last day. So, otherwise, grammatically, pretty easy. Anything on verse 26? We'll just keep forging ahead. We've got some great imperatives coming up. So. All right? Verse 27. Gegrat taigar, for it is written. And now he quotes Isaiah from the Septuagint. Ilfrante te stera he u tiktuza. Preksan kai baezan he uk odinuza. Hati pala ta tekna tes. Eremu malan e tes echuzes tan andra. The first verb form is from euphrino. It's a liquid stem verb, which means it's evil. Euphrino in the active means to gladden. It makes to cheer someone up. This is aorist imperative passive, third, excuse me, second singular. Okay, if the active means to gladden, what would the passive be? To be gladdened, okay? But this is one of those many verbs, and Dr. Veltz's grammar points this out, where the passive voice will have an active, intransitive meaning. So not be gladdened, but simply what?
Be glad.
Be glad. Right. Second person singular. Be glad. Stera is an adjective, feminine singular nominative, and it means sterile. That's where we get our English word sterile. Barren. And it's acting here like a noun. Barren one. Okay? Now let's modify the barren one. He u tiktuza. Tikto means to have a kid, right? To bear a child. Barren one who is not having children, right? Now we've got hreikson and baeson. These are both. The only way to remember the imperative endings is to pray. Especially the second singular. They're so irregular. These are both weak aorists. You can maybe see the sigma in the stem. It's from regnomy, of all things. Okay? So, yeah, the only way to pray is you better click and point. Point and click, you know, in some computer program, right? Regnomy means to tear, so a Texan actually suggested to me that we should translate this imperative, cut loose. Okay? And I like that. Cut loose and shout. Bo'a'o. Right? To cry out, right? Second singular imperative active, aorist. Cut loose and cry out, the one not laboring. Right? Another participle that modifies, in this case there's just an article on the front of it and it's turned it into a noun, right? The not laboring one. Okay, now trivia time. Who can tell me, at least in the New Testament, why that uk is unusual? Hey, uk odinusa.
Participles?
Yeah, it's actually negating a participle. In the New Testament, you would almost always negate a participle, not with uk, but with
may.
Right. But it's from the Septuagint. It's quoting the Septuagint, and the usage there is more complex, as it is in better Greek or older Greek than the New Testament. So cut loose and shout, the one who does not labor. Why? Hati. Because many the children of... Now you see erema mu and you think of the noun desert, right? But it is an adjective and it means barren or deserted, right? It's the feminine form is the same as the masculine, right? The children of the barren one. Because many... Now give me a verb. Are... The children of the barren one, malon, rather a, is our little word, than, rather than of the having the husband one, of the one who has a husband. Okay? And of course, and that, what's going on in Isaiah 54, Tim? It's a prophecy after exile or something?
Yeah.
You know, the return after exile and the invitation to rejoice prophetically? Right. And so Paul takes that and he applies that to the present Christian experience, right, of rejoicing because the above Jerusalem has many children. That is to say, all believers, Jew and Gentile. In fact, more children than the one who is the Jerusalem below. So the grammar is not too bad. If your head is spinning a little bit hermeneutically, that's fine. Go ahead and take the elective in Galatians, and we'll get it all figured out. So, questions just about the language of verse 27. It's almost time to stop. The language?
The language.
Yeah, like the grammar, the syntax, the things like that. So, or anything else you want to tie?
Well, I was just curious about this ook thing because I was wondering if. When they were translating into the Septuagint, were they equating ook with a certain negative, you know, particle or something from
probably low as opposed to all.
But you don't know with the Septuagint how consistent they are, and
Right.
Someone probably does that.
Yeah. Well, and even from book to book, I mean, you don't have the same translator, right? So you sometimes it's very wooden. You know what's really fun is to read the Septuagint with Dr. Seleska. We did that one summer. Yeah, but I won't tell the story that I always tell about the donkey and stuff. So, so it's all good. So, okay. Well, it is 12:45. We should stop here. Thank you for coming to Greek Club.
Thank you.
Lectionary lunch tomorrow. Hebrew Club on Thursday.